Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Okay, sure, yeah, coming from that, so, okay. So, listeners, here we are with Thrive Deeper 137 with
137. I wonder how many hours that'd be. Yeah, you know, because some of them have been over an hour, so that's like, man, that's right. A lot of hours.
That's right. It should have only really been about 70 hours, but it's ended up being about 160 hours. I think.
I see, Stu. I like the difference between your old-fashioned paper Bible there, and my iPad.
Yeah, I noticed that too. But
I'm the iPad. Actually, for all of my reading, because I can add notes, I can cut and paste. Great. I love my.
It's great. I think it's more of my
digital version.
Pay grade, actually. I can only afford the paper version, and you've got the technology.
Hey, they're not cheap.
No, that's true. In fact, they're getting more expensive than the digital version.
Yeah,
but anyway
that's
so
right.
We're going to try to move through the last part of the last Thrive booklet, because we know we're into the new one now as we're into February.
But we're looking at Solomon, really, aren't we?
Right. Yeah. And we're going to look at that largely in the Book of Kings, but you know, also we're referencing to Chronicles, and I think just one of the things I discovered as I was researching this is these are written at quite different times people in different contexts, a bit like the Gospels, where the same story, but they're dealing with a different issue and speaking in a different way. And Kings was written during the exile and is really kind of looking at what went wrong and how did we end up here.
That's right.
Whereas Chronicles was written after the return from the exile.
Yeah, that's right.
And they're going, how do we make sure we don't get here again, kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's amazing actually to see how those differences of perspective actually reflect on what gets chosen to put, you know, and what gets expanded on. Mm. And of course, you know, they're not just making it up at the time. Let's just add little bits here and embellish the story. They're actually working from official records that were written at the time. Mm. And in fact, they're footnoting in their own way. You know, you have comments like, and the other events of the reign of such and such are recorded in. And they actually mention the records.
That's right.
And that happens throughout Kings and Chronicles. So, you know, the interesting thing about Chronicles, and we'll focus on Kings today as we look at Solomon, but Chronicles gives us a lot more, expands a lot on the temple building stuff.
It's written from a priestly perspective rather than from a sort of a political perspective.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Because, of course, the big issue in the post-exilic period when they come back is the rebuilding of the temple and re-establishment of the temple services. And so, you know, so that's going to be a big deal in Chronicles. You know, whereas in Kings, again, as you said, the emphasis is on where did we go wrong here? Where did we go wrong? Now, it's interesting, just big picture, I think, about the life of Solomon as we reflect on the life of Solomon. There's this interesting thing that happens in the Bible with the connection between the one and the many. So you have the representative sort of head of the nation or representative kind of prophetic people that in a way embody or symbolize the people as a whole. So, for example, we see this, I think, in the book of Judges in Samson.
Right.
You know, the story of Samson. Famous, let's just take the story of Samson and Delilah. You know, this story of how, you know, Delilah keeps duping Samson into giving away a secret. And he lies the first few times just to see what she'll do if he gives her the secret of his strength.
Yes.
And, of course, she betrays him.
Yes.
And then he lies to her again. She betrays him again. She lies to him again. He betrays him again. And then he finally tells the truth. And you think, what is going on? Why would you do that? And this is my point. The kind of question about why. What a strange story, and why, you know, why is that recorded there? Well, of course, this is exactly Israel. This is what Israel are doing. They're being drawn again and again and again, absolutely duped into the idolatry of the nations.
Yes.
Which is sort of represented by this relationship between Samson and Delilah. And being oppressed again and again. And so you have this this sense in which Samson is a kind of prophetic symbol of the nation as a whole.
Yes.
Well, it's exactly the same with Solomon in a sense here.
Yes.
And if you look at the at the way that Solomon's life is presented, particularly in the Book of Kings. You know, at the start, Solomon is this wise, you know, his rule is established. He's this wise man who's given this wisdom, you know,
yes.
wisdom and discernment. And of course, you know, to Israel was given the revelation of God. The
That's
wisdom
right.
of God was yeah. given to Israel. They were enriched and blessed by God, and yet they fall into idolatry. Mm. They follow the ways of the nations around them, and they gradually fall away.
And it's little bit by little bit. It's not like there's one big thing.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It's like gradually, you
yeah,
know,
that's right.
they're being duped, as you
exactly.
said.
Exactly. You know. And that's what, you know, that's what, in a sense, the life of Solomon is a kind of a nutshell answer to the question mm. posed by mm. the exiles. Mm. How did we get here? Well, Solomon's life is a kind of picture
yes.
of the trajectory of Israel that we'll read about through the Book of Kings.
Yeah, yeah, that's yeah. great. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. So I think that kind of big picture stuff, it highlights something about the text, that there's more, like these stories are chosen to portray something. This isn't just history, it's actually
right.
prophecy.
It's to do something.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So they're quoting, they're, you know, they're drawing from historical, official historical records,
mm.
but the way that this is put together by, you know, prophetic groups, prophetic or priestly groups,
mm.
in this case, in the case of the Book of Kings, in the exile, to carry a prophetic message.
That's right.
And I think that's, you know, it's important to recognize that aspect. That's why, you know, they recognize in Solomon a kind of prophetic message, a prophetic warning for the nation.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that's an important
good.
Sort of big picture
Absolutely.
Thing. Now, Stu, you had some concerns at one stage about Shimei. Let's talk about Shimei.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't want to go there because I thought that's
no, that's
be
right.
a distraction.
It's not getting us off because it actually leads into some important points about the transition between David and Solomon.
Mm.
Because, of course, and this is fairly customary for one king to pass on responsibilities.
Yes.
To the next king. So the, you know, the king who's coming onto the throne is, mm. in a sense, inheriting the responsibilities of the former king.
Which includes the justice of the former
which,
king.
Yeah, and, yep. and this is particularly for, you know, God's sort of vision of kingship.
Mm.
You know, the king is very much the one responsible for maintaining justice. That
yes.
is actually, you know, keeping the there are two main roles, keeping the nation on track mm. in with God. So it's sort of the guardian of the faithfulness of the nation. Now, of course, the priests were responsible for the teaching, and mm. but, you know, the king was to ensure that was always central.
Yeah.
Secondly, the king was to ensure justice.
Yes.
You know, and so a lot of this section in chapter 2, mm. which talks about David's charge to Solomon, is about tying up loose ends. It's,
yeah.
it's sort of, you know, because he's going through, like, for example, with Joab, you know,
yes.
Who was the commander of the army. Now, Joab committed two murders,
yep.
two killings that were quite personal.
Yes, they were.
That were...
Vengeance, really.
Really vengeance, yeah. Mm. David at the time, Joab's an interesting guy.
Well,
actually.
David had to let it go, really, because Joab was the guy that David yeah. got. So how is he going to call this guy out?
Yeah, exactly.
He's the guy who asked him to murder. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So he's quite, you know, in some ways, you know, David kind of needed Joab in a sense. Mm. But he left those crimes, those blood crimes...
Mm.
Undealt with. And that's
yeah.
a problem. That's an important loose end, mm. actually.
Mm.
And see, this isn't about David, you know, getting, like, this isn't personal.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what we've got to recognize about this. It's him in his role as king.
And trying to set an example for future generations.
That's
Don't
right.
leave loose ends or you,
yeah.
they're going to come back and
yeah.
potentially
that's
bite
right.
you later.
And we might think, particularly from a Christian point of view, we might think, he should have forgiven them and let them off. And, you know, but no, this is actual civil justice here, you know. So it's a good judge just doesn't let everyone off who, you know, because there are families involved here that are still alive, the families of the men that he killed.
Yeah, that's
right. And they're like, what's...
Yeah, that's right.
You know...
And it becomes a model to others who then go, well, if that's okay for the king...
Yeah,
and then,
exactly.
You know, or for Joab, it's probably okay for us. So let's look about Shimei before we move off to that, because Shimei was the guy that kind of cursed David when he was heading back out.
That's right. So David is fleeing from Jerusalem, from Absalom. Shimei is walking along the ridge of a hill and he's cursing David.
And throwing stones at him.
And he's throwing stones at him. Now, this is a problem. Again, this is a capital crime, according to Exodus. I think Exodus 22 says, do not blaspheme God or curse the leader of your people.
Yeah.
So,
But I guess at this time, Shimei didn't think he was the leader anymore because, as far as he was concerned, Absalom was. So that may not have entered Shimei's mind.
Yeah. So Shimei's got a political thing because he's a Saul. He's part of Saul's group, really. And so there's something here for Shimei as well. It wasn't, you know, he wasn't just in a prophetic role.
Yeah, no.
No, he just hated David and he was always on Saul. You know, so he's part of this, you know, he's part of a sort of subversive group, it seems.
Yep.
Okay. Now, at the time, David says quite ambiguously, I may say that he's going to let Shimei live, but he puts that in a kind of
this is probably God's will that I get cursed.
Kind of thing. And, but still, this is an issue. There's probably two issues here with Shimei, and this is part of the loose end. There's a capital crime here. In some ways, you might say that there's a spiritual aspect to this, in the sense that those who curse you,
that's right.
Genesis chapter 12: those who curse you, I will curse. So, you know, Shimei didn't just insult David. This is not just an honor.
That's right.
Honor killing.
Mm.
He actually cursed. He cursed David.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal. That's a very big deal at this time. And as I said, it's a capital crime. So that's a significant loose end. Now, it's interesting when Solomon goes to deal with this, he actually doesn't just go out.
No, that's right.
And dispense with Shimei. He actually says, okay, you're going to stay in the city. But if you leave the city,
then you're going to get,
then you'll
die on that day, basically.
Then you will die on that day. Mm. Now, this is because Shimei, remember, is part of an anti-David, anti-Davidic dynasty subversive group.
Right? So he's trying to keep them contained. Yeah. Yep.
So he's trying to keep them contained. Like so he's preventing him from going and essentially conspiring with other Benjamites in these other territories. You know, anyway, so that's how Shimei dies, because, of course, he crosses that line.
Yeah, so just coming back to the issue for that, because, we probably know what we're talking about, but at the time, David promised he wouldn't kill Shimei, wouldn't take his life. And then on his deathbed, he kind of says to Solomon, hey, I didn't take care of this guy, but hey, you go take care of him.
Yeah, that's right. Because, David says that he wouldn't.
That's right.
But that didn't mean that, it's a bit of a loophole there. And it's interesting that there are mixed, this kind of does get mixed reviews in the commentaries. I think, and because we don't have to say that David did everything right either.
No, that's exactly right.
You know.
But even one of the things David didn't do right was all these little poor decisions along the way, you know, where he didn't, deal with justice appropriately and so it's like, at this point, he's saying, I've got to set this up for the next generation.
Yeah.
They need to know it's not acceptable.
That's right.
The minute we compromise in one place, we risk compromise.
Yeah, that's right. So David is trying to, is advising Solomon, here are the things that are going to probably cause you problems.
Yep.
The thing with, say, Joab, the reason why he needs to be dealt with too is that he's quite a divisive figure.
Yeah.
You know, he's a guy that gets hot under the collar and he's, he's saying that this guy's going to cause you problems, particularly because he's gotten away with some serious stuff.
Yes.
And he's going to think, he's a very powerful guy. I mean, he's the head of the
very
military.
Influential, exactly
very
right.
influential. Mm. And I think David senses he's gonna cause you problems, and Shimei is gonna cause you problems, and so this is the,
that's good.
These are the loose ends. So.
Yeah, no, it's good to deal with.
Good.
Thanks for humouring me on that one.
Yeah, that's right. the wisdom, you know, the, I mean, it starts with Solomon's wisdom. I've talked about, you know, the importance of that. And I think that sets a kind of agenda too for biblical rulers. It's not and what's depicted here isn't a kind of a Machiavellian nous, you know. It's not just about being politically shrewd, or although, smart, you know, there's a real sense of kind of godly wisdom here. Mm. Although, the two get mixed in here a bit, you know, in his burgeoning ambition, which is an issue, becomes an issue for Solomon. You know, he gets a taste of power, and then it goes to his head, and then the wisdom probably does turn into a slightly more
political
maneuvering thing, which actually doesn't work out so well. No. Actually, in the end, it's a bit of a disaster, and we'll talk about that. But we have we have Solomon given this gift of wisdom and discernment, And that's a real godly thing. That's connected with godliness, this wisdom. We'll talk about Solomon in big chunks, I think, Stu, rather than go through the details of the story.
The first sort of demonstration, I guess, of this godly wisdom was with the two mothers and the baby.
Yeah.
And
That's right. That's a famous story about
big story that.
And this is not only about. That's not only about wisdom, that's about showing that Solomon is a man who's prepared to do justice.
Yes. Yeah.
That's an important thing there. So the first big project, of course, is the building of the temple.
Yes.
Now, Solomon does a couple of things. He builds the temple, but he also, and I'm going to go back to just the beginning of chapter 3.
Yep.
There's just an important detail there. He marries Pharaoh's daughter.
Yes.
And this is the reason why this is connected with the building thing is because he builds her a palace. In fact, the whole palace complexes.
Mm.
Of course, Chronicles very much remembers David for the temple building.
Yes.
Which is a wonderful thing that he did. But he actually spends twice as much time, just about, building the palace complexes. Now, part of this is warranted because, you know, you've got, I mean, there's just so much needed for the administration. But, you know, he's building a palace for Pharaoh's daughter.
Yes.
So that palace for Pharaoh's daughter is part of a kind of a hold, I guess, that Pharaoh has on Solomon.
It's a political alliance.
Yeah,
really.
It's an alliance, but it comes with some serious strings attached. Yeah.
Well, the Pharaohs never gave their daughters away to foreign kings.
No, not normally. So this is a statement about Solomon's status.
Yes.
That he marries. Like, he's the equal of the Pharaohs. Pharaoh. And that's a big deal in the ancient world. These guys were really big time. Now, the relationship with this pharaoh was good. The next one, it's going to really deteriorate. But this is where, you know, you get this problematic thing here. Now, interestingly, David delays in building the temple, partly because he's doing a lot of, you know, he's building a palace as well. Solomon delays.
That's right.
Solomon delays the work. And you sense, you get this because it says in chapter 3, verse 2, the people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because the temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Mm. This is the first sort of indication that you get in the reign of Solomon of some problems here. And I think it's most probably connected with the alliance with Pharaoh and the marrying of Pharaoh's daughter, which we then find out that he builds a palace for her.
Yes.
So he's preparing this palace for the daughter of Pharaoh, and he's securing this alliance, and that actually delays things.
For
the temple. Mm. And all the while, the people are going up to these high places, which were traditional in that part of the world. You know, the top of mountains was seen as in some ways overlapping with the heavenly realm.
Yeah.
And so all of the very traditional cultic centers for Canaanite religions were at those places. They that's where you go to connect with the gods. Yes. And so the people may have gone up there maybe to offer sacrifices to Yahweh, the God of Israel, maybe, but there's a lot of syncretism going on there. Mm-hmm. And so this is a bit of a problem. So already there we sense, okay, there are some problems. The people are already kind of going astray. Mm. And Solomon, of course, participates in that. So this is the first indication that we get.
And again, really to appease his wife.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, to keep the peace in a sense.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. Because she's a worshiper of these pagan gods and so forth. But he does, you know, he does build the temple and this is given a lot of, as I said, a lot more emphasis in Chronicles. But we have this, this very significant moment where the glory of the Lord fills the temple. So the temple takes the place of the tabernacle in that sense. It's a kind of a portal between heaven and earth, in a sense, you know. And it's interesting that it's, you know, in the ancient world, temples were seen to be the home of gods. That's where the gods lived. Now, it's not quite the same because, as Solomon says, you know, the heavens, the highest heavens cannot contain you. How much less this temple that I've built, as Solomon says that in his prayer. Mm. But it's said of the temple that it is built for the name of the Lord. Right. It's a really interesting statement, actually, that it's built for the name of the Lord. What does that mean, that it contains the name of the Lord? Mm. Well, the name means this is who God had promised to be for his people. This is, in the name of God is in a sense, all of the promises.
Yeah.
The revealed God, the God who says, "I will be this for you."
Right.
So it's a kind of a symbolic, it symbolizes who God had promised to be and what he had promised to do. And of course, we've got all the sacrifices that absolutely showed symbolically, which is what's different to other temples, which were just like houses of pagan gods.
Yeah, right.
There's a symbolism, very complex symbolism associated with the temple, brought over actually, you know, of course, from the tabernacle.
Yeah.
That symbolizes exactly what God had done, is doing, and will do for his people. So it's in that sense that God's name is there, because the promises and the purposes of God are being enacted every single day.
It's God's reputation.
That's right. Exactly. And so Solomon's builds the temple, and the promise of God is that God will answer the prayers prayed towards this place. Interestingly, not that the temple is a sort of a magic,
luck charm.
It's not a good luck charm.
No.
The significance of praying towards that place is that it's an expression of faith.
Okay. Yep.
You're praying in faith in everything that symbolized, in the sacrifice ultimately, of course, that symbolized Christ.
Mm, that's right.
So it's, in a sense, praying toward the temple is what we would say
in Jesus' name. Yeah. And Jesus called himself the temple, you know, tear down this temple and I will
rebuild
it in 3
exactly.
days.
Exactly. You know, so they are, you know, it's in that sense that it contains the name of the Lord.
Yep.
And then it's interesting because God makes these promises and then Solomon prays.
Yes.
You know, when you always have this pattern, you know, God makes a promise and then the key figure prays that back. You know, it's almost like an agreement. Lord, would you do what you have said?
Yes.
Really important. It's not just going to be automatic.
Yeah, no, that's right. And it speaks to us today about the importance of prayer, because
exactly.
we can kind of think, well, if God already knows what needs to happen here, why do I need to pray about that?
Yeah, that's right.
Why is prayer important?
And, you know, and in this case, because, you know, Solomon is responsible here. So do you want God to do something? I mean, God's not just going to undercut your authority.
Yes.
He put Solomon in charge in the same way as we are authorized, given authority in Christ to influence our environment. God is saying, well, do you want me to do something? You know, I promise you that I will, but it's through prayer that we draw down on those on those promises.
That's great.
So you see that in a, you know, we see Solomon, and again, importantly, a demonstrating biblical prayer.
Yes.
You know, which is very much based on the promises of God. Again, which is very it's a real contrast to you know, the kind of prayers that people prayed.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no sense of assurance or you know, and again, it's this idea of praying towards the temple with this sense of basis for that.
And as you say, the promises of God are for the purposes of God.
Yeah,
so essentially
that's right.
You're praying back what God has promised.
Exactly, yeah, that's right. So, of course, Solomon is enormously successful as a king. He's, I mean, and this is David's conquests, of course. He inherits David's conquests.
Mm.
Solomon doesn't have to ever go to war, interestingly. He's really the only king that doesn't have to.
It was an era of peace and prosperity,
this is
really
a golden age in many ways, the reign of Solomon. Golden age in many senses. He establishes a sort of a genre of wisdom writing. This would have been an important cultural age as the services of the temple and the musical guilds all really take their mature shape during you know, the arts in the time of Solomon. It's a time of enormous political influence. So Solomon rules over like a huge territory.
Yeah, and lots of kings from other countries are coming to him seeking his advice and his wisdom.
So the visit of the Queen of Sheba is, it's not just a nice story, it's an indication of the influence. And that's important because remember, this is not just a political history.
Yeah, that's right.
This is the way that the Bible works is God said and it was.
Mm.
We you know, God had made certain promises about his people. And we see that being fulfilled in the reign of Solomon. So God gifts Solomon, and therefore the peoples from distant nations come to seek that wisdom.
Yeah.
That's a really important idea.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a fulfillment of Genesis 12:3. Promise to Abraham, and all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you.
Yeah.
So. And you know, we have these promises in Isaiah, for example, of the, you know, Israel being a light to the nations. That's another expression, pictorial expression of that promise to Abraham, being a light to the nations. So here we see the fulfillment of that as Solomon is established, the Queen of Sheba from this. Yeah, and that's kind of, that's about as far away as they knew.
Yeah, that's right.
In that time.
Yeah.
So, you know, so the Queen of Sheba comes and visits and says, look, not even the half has been told to me. And it's probably...
And brings huge gifts and, you know, which clearly speaks of his status in terms of know, how he's viewed by them, even with only hearing, as you say, half of what she saw when she came and heard from Solomon. So significant.
Yeah, you know. So very significant moment in the story. That's like, I think that... The visit of the Queen of Sheba is like this pinnacle point.
Yes. Kind of goes downhill from there, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it does. And it's interesting because there are a lot of things going on here, even around that we're given hints that this is kind of problematic.
Yeah.
Like this is going well, but it's never – it's mixed.
Mm.
For example, Solomon is amassing horses and chariots.
Yeah.
And the Charter of Kings in Deuteronomy 17 says he should not get many horses.
And foreign wives.
That's right.
And he should not. Worshipping other gods.
He should not amass silver and gold. We see that. I mean, even though God is blessing, God blesses him.
Yes.
Yet Solomon is positively doing things to increase his. I mean, this is going to be a big focus for him.
He's hoarding in some ways. He's just trying to build his reputation by how much of everything
he's got. That's right. We'll get to the wives in a moment.
Yeah,
but the hoarding of gold is problematic because to do this, he has to enter into alliances, trade alliances with foreign nations.
Yeah.
That in one sense, okay, that's innocent enough, but this is going to cost.
Yeah,
this is going to cost. So he enters into an alliance with the Phoenicians, who were just to the north. They're on the sort of northern coast, present-day Lebanon, and they're a shipping people. So in a sense, what we see here is Solomon controls the land trade, whereas they control the sea trade. So between – I mean, it's a smart move.
Yes.
Because between – you know, that alliance basically form – you then have a monopoly of trade in the region, sea trade. And so the Phoenicians are operating out of Tyre and Sidon, the ports up to the north. But they're also operating down south in the Gulf of Aqaba, which is the other finger of the Red Sea, if you can imagine.
Yep.
If you can. And Solomon – actually, we know now Solomon has very rich copper mines down there that he's operating, and so this is being shipped all over the place. Now, this alliance with the Phoenicians becomes problematic in the future because how do you seal alliances? You seal that through marriage. Okay. Yeah. Now let's go. You know, just anticipating going forward a little bit. Israel becomes quite dependent then on this alliance with the Phoenicians. This is a relationship that becomes really problematic during Ahab's time, because of course Ahab, to keep this alliance, marries a Phoenician princess, and her name is Jezebel.
Jezebel, that's exactly.
And the story of Jezebel and Ahab is famous. Yep. She famously, you know, is the one that persecutes the prophet and is chasing after Elijah. She's this sort of almost demonic kind of figure. This all starts from Solomon trying to increase his wealth and influence.
And essentially taking things into his own hands.
That's right.
Again.
Which God promised that he would make him prosperous.
Yes.
But he's doing things here. He gets a lot of gold from the king of Tyre, from Hiram. It's interesting actually also that the king of Tyre in Isaiah is characterized as a kind of almost a type of Satan himself.
Right.
You know, those famous passages about, I think it's Isaiah in Isaiah about the fall of Satan from heaven, and it's actually about the king of Tyre.
Right.
So it's speaking about the king of Tyre, who is characterized in accordance with the sort of story of the fall of Satan from heaven and so forth. And so anyway, it's interesting, given the foothold that Tyre is going to have in the kingdom of Israel at this point. Just an interesting point there. So the other problem with this wealth creating machine. Oh, actually, I was just going to say, because he gets a whole lot of gold from Hiram, he has to sell 10
cities
to him.
That's right, in North Galilee.
This is 10 cities of the promised land.
Mm.
He actually has to, Hiram isn't even too impressed with that. Yeah, so you see things deteriorating there because Solomon's not quite keeping up.
Yes,
with expenses at this point.
Yeah.
So he's having to tax the people.
Yeah,
he's having to overwork the people. That's going to cause problems, the overworking of the people, because we're going to get a revolution really under Jeroboam, who's the leader of the workforces there. But let's talk about the many foreign wives thing.
Yes.
One of the other things that we read in Deuteronomy 17 in the Charter for Kings is that he should not have many wives.
Yes. And shouldn't marry wives from other nations because they will draw him away.
That's right.
Adultery.
So 700?
Yeah, it seems like
I think that classes as many. I think we safely can say that classes as many. And I think that's a kind of round figure.
Yes.
Because it's saying something. This is like
a lot.
Because, you know, seven has that sense of fullness or completion. Like this is the fullness of his stupidity, in a sense, of his disobedience.
Yes.
Now, each of those, Solomon letting his, desire go uncontrolled. Certainly that's happening. So that's part of this.
But it's also political.
It's political, of course, because all of these wives
represent some trade alliance somewhere, right, or some relationship that needs to be protected.
And exactly. So this is part of his ambition. So to have a large harem of wives in the ancient world is a sign of political influence.
Yeah.
If you've got many, many wives, that shows, particularly, drawn from nobility. That's this is right. probably the difference between wives and concubines. I mean, the wives were represented those political and trade alliances. Yeah. So this is part of his compromise. I mean, he's building his – it's like – it's the classic thing of God promises you something and then you do it your own way. I mean, this is Genesis. You know, man is created in God's image, in his likeness.
Yes.
But then Satan tempts Adam
Here's
and Eve.
A better way.
Yeah. Do this and you will be like God.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
It's like – but hang on. But they were already created in God's likeness. Yeah. But no, they're going to do it their own way. And so you see something promised to Solomon and yet he's going to attain it his own way.
Mm. And also just the fact that he got such wealth became a distraction in itself. I mean, it's where we get complacent and it's like, I don't need God anymore in a sense. I can do this.
Yeah. So it's not, so the problem isn't the wealth as such. It's that, cause that of course was promised, but it was the way that he went about that. Now remember, this is,
became obsessive for him.
Yeah. And remember, this is a prophetic story talking to the exiles. Mm. This is how things go wrong.
Mm.
I said I would give you, can trust me for this.
Yes.
I said I would bless you, right?
Yes.
Don't make compromises going after blessing.
Yes.
In your own way.
Mm.
Trust me for this.
Mm.
And of course, when you look at the history of Israel and Judah that follows after this, that's pretty much the story of their demise. They do things in their own way.
Exactly. Well, even leading up to it, as we talked in the last episode, we talked about the ark, needed to be carried in a particular way, and it wasn't.
That's right.
These little compromises that cost a lot.
Yeah, that's right. So, so we see this in the latter stage of Solomon's rule. We have different people rebelling against him.
Mm. He ruled for about 40 years, I think, wasn't it, in total?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But we have these Hadad and rebels against him. Then we have this other guy, his name has gone out of my Rezin. Sorry, I just lost his name there. They've got gripes from the time of David.
Yep.
And it's almost, you get this sense that God is holding that back, but as things go wrong and as Solomon is weakening, they're getting more courage.
Emboldened, exactly.
Hadad, the Edomite, because Edom is down towards Egypt, he initially fled to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh is actually giving him shelter.
Right.
This is the next Pharaoh. So this is not the Pharaoh
who was David's father-in-law.
David's father-in-law, that's right.
Yep.
This is the Pharaoh after that now, and things are really deteriorating here. This is a Pharaoh that's becoming more powerful now, and he's... It's interesting because he's now backing these guys against Solomon.
Yes.
I think he sees Solomon's things are crumbling.
Yeah.
So I'm going to back Hadad now. And so that's a sign of Solomon's demise.
Yeah.
Of course, Solomon's furiously trying to
prop things up.
Mm. And again, overworking his workforce. Head of the workforce is Jeroboam.
Mm.
And you get this moment where through the prophet, Prophet Ahijah goes to Jeroboam saying, I'm tearing 10 tribes away from Solomon and I'm going to give them to you.
Yes.
So a divided heart in Solomon leads to a divided kingdom.
Yes.
We get this and it doesn't happen, this rebellion doesn't happen in Solomon's lifetime, but it does happen in the lifetime of his son Rehoboam. And it's actually this Pharaoh actually attacks Israel during Rehoboam's reign. But in the next generation, Jeroboam is going to lead this rebellion and it's going to create two kingdoms, a divided kingdom, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom.
Yeah.
So, that becomes, that's sort of the story moving on from there.
Yeah.
So it's a great tragedy because, of course, David is the one who is, unites the tribes, and he unites the tribes around the central, around the worship of Yahweh. That's what unites them.
Mm.
But the moment things turn away from that, the moment they stray away, the moment they become like other nations, what do you get? Fragmentation.
Yeah.
And that, in a sense, the prophetic message here, it's like Babel all over again.
Yes.
Right? You start, you want to be a temple builder or a tower builder?
Yes.
Right? Because when you build the temple, you unite the people. Yep. When you build a tower,
you divide.
You divide, just like happened in Genesis 11 at the Tower of Babel when they built this tower and God, as a judgment, fragmented the people and scattered them, turning them against each other. And that's exactly what you have. So essentially, yes, Solomon builds, in summary, I guess, of the life of Solomon. Yes, he does build a temple. That's great. God gives him this. But what went wrong? Essentially, he builds a Tower of Babel, in essence.
Yeah.
And as a result, you get fragmentation.
Yep.
Things fall apart.
Yeah.
It's such a powerful prophetic message.
And it seems like such little compromise. As you read through it, you kind of go, oh, what's the big deal about that? And then you go back and you see specifically why that's a big deal.
That's right.
And again, God is a God of the details.
Yeah.
As we saw in the dimensions and how to build the temple, it's not just getting the thing done. It's not the goal. It's actually the way.
Exactly. Done, exactly. So that's the life of Solomon. In the next episode, Stu, we'll look at the sort of trajectory and the patterns that follow from this. It's an amazing, the patterns and the story in the Book of Kings is amazing. I think a lot of people get a little lost here.
Yes.
But what we'll try to do is, in our characteristic big picture way, we'll try to sort of guide people through that.
And of course, in the next episode, pattern. We're jumping to the New Testament.
We're jumping to Romans first, and then we're going to come back to this. Because we do two Old Testament editions in terms of the Thrive booklets and to every one New Testament one.
I think it'd be good before we wrap up, just Solomon reflects on his life towards the end of his days.
Yeah, that's right.
And he sort of speaks to the fact that all of that he was chasing actually amounted to
nothing.
That's
right. So the book of Ecclesiastes is either written by Solomon or someone, because it's very literary in form, it's either written by Solomon or someone who is almost taking on the character of a Solomonic figure. Reflecting on that, and it gives the sort of therefore. I think it reflects the fact that Solomon kind of realized one way or another, I think realized, where he was a man with wisdom. I think he would have. I don't think it matters because there's a big debate about whether Ecclesiastes is actually written by Solomon. Or
about him.
Yeah, or in that wisdom tradition. Because remember, in a sense, Solomon founds this literary tradition, this almost guild of wisdom writers. Okay. Yep. So it's someone, it's either Solomon or someone within that.
Yes, okay.
That inherits the lessons of that period.
Yes.
And writes about that. And so we get the... we get the reflections of that. And I think, the classic thing is, vanity, vanity, meaningless, meaningless. Yes. It was all a chasing after the wind. So much of Solomon's effort was just futile because it all crumbled in the end. Right. It was lost.
Yeah.
The great thing that he created just dissolved in the end. And only what God did in the midst of it, only that remains.
That's what survived. And Solomon wrote that in the Psalms, unless the Lord builds the house, labor in vain. So, he recognized that there. Yeah. And I guess it asks the question of us, what are we living for? Are we living for our own kind of purposes, which are going to fade to nothing, or are we living for God's purpose?
That's right. So you think, when you look at what remains after all is said and done in Solomon's reign, what remains is exactly what God had promised to David. I will give you a son always on the throne. I will establish your dynasty. Even though he tears 10 tribes away, he says, for the sake of my servant David, he's going to hold on to the throne. So he's not going to lose it completely. You get exactly what God promised. in the end. And it's all that's left, all of the political stuff, the tower, in a sense, dissolves. The temple remains.
Yes.
The purposes of God remain.
Yes.
Everything that God said would happen continues to happen. That, in the end, is the only thing that matters, and that, in the end, is the only thing left.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact and see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these inspire you to go deeper and thrive.